Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Gass. He's an assistant professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University. His research and teaching interests lie at the intersection of political communication, public opinion, and political behavior via a combination of experimental methods, large data sets, machine learning, and innovative measurement. He studies how people choose, process, spread, and respond to information about politics. And today we're going to talk about politics and the digital media. So, Dr. Gass, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I mean, people nowadays are talking a lot about political polarization, but particularly in the context of digital media, do we find lots of political polarization there or not?
Well, I think it depends on how you ask the question. So, on the one hand, if you look at the level of sort of the media ecosystem, or you could think of as the supply of political information, I think it's pretty clear that it's quite polarized. So if you think about especially online media as being sort of a collection of different like sources and outlets and websites and apps and this sort of thing, there are clearly different clumps that correspond to different political communities. This has been visualized in various ways that I'm sure you've seen. People have done this in the US, and like you can see this in other countries as well. But at least in the US context that I'm the most familiar with, you tend to see sort of a big sort of mainstream clump of news sources, and they're dominated by, several well-known outlets. And then there's a separate clump that's sort of like, sort of conservative partisan media that's its own sort of mini ecosystem that's dominated by things like Fox News and Breitbart. And then, there's also a partisan sort of left-wing mini ecosystem that's much smaller and that actually has much closer ties to just like the mainstream ecosystem. But, regardless of how you interpret it or cut it, like there are clearly sort of divides and clear communities on the kind of ecosystem side. But then you could also look at it from the individual side, so sort of from the demand side. And there, I think it's a bit more of a complicated answer because once you take into account, A, most people don't really pay that much attention to politics, no matter where you are. B, the people that do tend to be very, very attentive and highly knowledgeable. And then C, even among those people, like relatively few of them are like super, super partisan. And so what that means is that like on average, the information diets of most people aren't as polarized as you might expect just from looking at the larger media landscape.
Okay, but I mean, what we get on digital media, does it reflect the political polarization as we find it in real life, or is it exaggerated on digital media?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's certainly difficult to disentangle. I mean, you said real life, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it means to
I
say like
mean, for a lack
real
of a
life.
better term, so.
Yeah, so I tend to focus on digital media. And like one of the things that you can say to like really upset people who study the internet like really, really easily is to say that there's real life, the say that online is not real life, right? So you have like real life and then you have online. Of course, everything is real and there's online and there's offline. So yeah, in any case, I think digital media is certainly a reflection of what happens in the larger political system. But it also can affect the political system. So I think it's a bit of a two-way street in terms of causality, and it's just difficult to disentangle. Certainly, the kinds of voices and ideas that that get a lot of attention on digital media are going to be more extreme and more inflammatory than I think you might see if you were to kind of turn on C-SPAN and tune into a random like debate on the floor of Congress, which would probably be pretty boring and dry. So if you think about that comparison, then yes, there is a sort of distorting field of digital media that focuses on things that are the most controversial and perhaps the most polarizing.
Yeah, but perhaps that was the kind of issue I was trying to talk about. So isn't it the case that because people in digital media particularly are exposed to a lot of extreme views, that perhaps that biases their perception of the levels of political polarization that really we find in society?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very amenable to that idea. There's a bit of research that looks into this phenomenon. So basically, the idea is that perceptions of polarization actually lead, you know, measures of objective polarization. And in fact, one might be driving the other. And so you could imagine how there could be sort of a feedback loop in which, you know, the media sort of writ large, you know, accentuates divisions and emphasizes polarization. You know, average person sort of like picks up on this conflict, and it either turns them off, or if they're like really engaged with conflict and they like it in some level, they like become really involved in it. But either way, you know, the people who are engaged with political media are sort of involved in this polarization process. And then for like normal people, they just observe it, they update and they think, oh, politics is all about polarization and conflict. I don't like that. And then that continues to feed into the system. So that's certainly something that I think is going on.
Mm-hmm. What about the phenomenon of echo chambers? What's that about?
So echo chambers are, so it's a concept that's been around for a while. And the basic idea is that, you know, technological change has increased the number of choices available to people for like learning about the world, basically sources of information. And the idea of echo chambers is that, you know, people have a tendency to self-select into sources of information that are congenial to their worldviews. And so if this happens at a societal level, you get just clumps of people who are like-minded getting their information from the same sources and also from each other. In a way that, you know, can lead to polarization or extremism and makes it more difficult for people to engage with people from the other side and even to kind of understand the perspective of people that are different from them. And so, you know, the concern about echo chambers is that there is this sort of interaction between people's general tendency to prefer information that they are inclined to agree with and the availability of many sources of information enabled by technology that make it really, really easy for people to self-select in this way. And in general, like the path of least resistance is to sort of, you know, find the things that you agree with and that that provide the least amount of cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm. But are echo chambers really a big thing on the internet? I mean, is that really that prevalent of a phenomenon?
So, I mean, if you look at the popular discussion around this, I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing around echo chambers. And I think that's because we all have sort of anecdotal experience with what these echo chambers can look like. I think the popular narrative is very clear, and it's like it's based on some element of truth. And that's the reason that this concept has been around with us for so long. And every time there's sort of a new development, say with the web and social media and mobile algorithmic filtering, like the same kind of concerns bubble up over and over again. But when you look at the evidence for the phenomenon, in a more rigorous way, I would say that the sort of the most like sort of the strongest claims in favor of echo chambers don't really hold up. And the reason for that is sort of what I alluded to earlier, that basically, you know, most people don't really care that much about politics. Most people don't read that much news or watch that much news. And so once you get down to the subset of people who really could be an echo chamber at all, it's not that large of a proportion of the population. Which is not to say that these echo chambers don't exist. They actually do. It's just that they are really among subsets of people who have the most polarized information diets and who are the most engaged with politics. So I think by any measure, these are not a huge chunk of the population. However, as you've sort of implied, they can have outsized influence because these are also people who tend to participate more in the political process. They also drive a lot of traffic to news sites, a disproportionate amount of traffic to news sites. And so news sites respond to that because, you know, they're looking at analytics and they're seeing which kinds of stories get the most engagement, and that leads them to produce more of the same kinds of stories. So it can create these kinds of feedback loop mechanisms that have larger, like, consequences for society. But it is being driven by, like, not a huge subset of the population. And that's the sort of weird, puzzling aspect of it that I think is sort of hard for people to kind of wrap their heads around.
But that small subset of the population that is part of echo chambers, does it influence the population at large in any way?
It's really hard to say. I think any question that involves the impact or consequences of, you know, media or digital media on any kind of societal outcome is just super, super difficult to answer, because it's just this huge interconnected system. And being able to say, well, what if we took this part of the system out? Like, what would things look like? That counterfactual is just, at some point, it's just impossible to test. And so we're sort of left to speculate. You know, certainly we do have these kinds of dynamics that we've been talking about. I think just the main point that I would like to convey is that it's really not the case that most people turn on their computers and, you know, they're bombarded with, you know, extreme homogenous political content from one side of the political spectrum or another, and that's all they see. I mean, that's just a caricature that is often implied by the discussion around these topics, but it's just generally not true.
But the kinds of content people are exposed to, political content on the internet, does it drive political polarization in any way? I mean, is there some sort of causal relationship between being exposed to some sort of extreme political content on the internet and becoming more politically polarized?
So there's been a bunch of attempts to study this in controlled ways. My attempt to sort of summarize this is basically that when you know, invite people into a lab and you have a pretty artificial setting and, you know, you try to test the effect of exposure to, you know, partisan content in this way, sort of in the way that you suggest, you can find that it makes people, you know, more extreme themselves, it increases their perceptions of polarization, et cetera. But it's not clear whether these effects sort of persist beyond the lab or if they generalize. Another interesting finding from these kinds of very controlled experiments is that it's often the people who are the least attentive and least engaged with politics who are affected the most. So it's not like the people who are most likely to consume partisan content are the ones who are becoming more polarized themselves. It's actually the people who wouldn't necessarily tune into this kind of content if it were up to them. But then when they are shown it, they're the ones who actually seem most susceptible to polarizing effects. And so that raises this sort of question. It's like, okay, you know, if I tune into like Fox News or like MSNBC, I'm probably most likely to agree with these things already, but if I happen to be flipping channel, and I come onto it, and then I watch it for a while, then, you know, if I'm sort of like a moderate, like politically not so interested person, that's the opportunity for the largest kind of media effects. So that's like kind of setting aside a bunch of kind of relatively controlled types of studies. Then there's attempts to kind of show this more in the real world, using behavioral data, that sort of thing. And there, I would say the evidence is a bit more mixed. So basically this question of like, okay, what happens when we take people out of the lab and we just look at the real world? I think there's so many like, you know, competing sources of information and like stimuli that people are exposed to, that it's difficult to say whether these kinds of effects just generalize and last.
But these effects you're talking about, do they translate into specific behaviors, like, for example, voting behavior and things like that?
So probably the most famous example of a study that tried to answer this question is looking at the effect of Fox News. So in the US, you have this cable channel that launches in the 90s. It kind of steadily becomes more kind of conservative in its orientation. And it sort of adds an element of choice to this existing cable news landscape. And so there have been a couple of studies that look at the rollout of this channel and try to see whether there's measurable impact on precinct level voting patterns. And so there have been two studies now that have shown in a couple of different ways that the rollout of Fox News or the existence of Fox News on the cable dial seems to be associated with more Republican, so more conservative voting patterns. Although that effect has sort of attenuated more recently. And so that would be pretty strongly suggestive evidence that, you know, new exposure to very targeted partisan information over a prolonged period of time can actually change voting behavior.
Right. So now talking about misinformation, what do we mean by misinformation when we try to study it in a digital context?
Yeah. So misinformation is the sort of catch-all term. It's been around for a long time, but there's been a lot of more recent interest in this topic as applied to digital media. Generally, the way that people define it is it's information that comes from information that is not supported by either verifiable facts or the current scientific consensus. Now, that's easier said than sort of applied in a specific case, and that's sort of the general difficulty with any kind of research in this area. Basically, it's this ground truth problem. In order to kind of study misinformation and its effects on society, you need to have a good kind of workable, scalable way to operationalize this concept of misinformation. And while it can be easy to say sort of in general, like, yes, misinformation is stuff that's not verified by facts and, you know, the current scientific consensus doesn't support it, it can often be difficult, like when you're looking at specific cases or specific claims, to come to an agreement on whether or not it constitutes misinformation. And that's the, you know, as someone who's been doing research in this area, that's probably the biggest challenge that we encounter. People don't always agree on the fundamental ground truth of specific topics. And so what you end up seeing in the research on misinformation on the internet is that there's a focus on the kinds of claims that are the most obviously false, right? So it's like you get the really egregious, easy to refute kinds of falsehoods because there the ground truth problem is a little less severe than it is on things that are still more contested. And so that's sort of like the challenge of this research. Because of course there's lots of misleading information, lots of biased claims kind of in the world. And it can be sort of difficult to sort of capture the extent and prevalence of all of that when you also want to stay on solid ground and be able to kind of point to the evidence for your claims.
Mm-hmm. But why is it so difficult for us to say what misinformation really is? Is it because there's no set of criteria that people agree on to say that a particular piece of content is misinformation or not? Or does it have to do with, for example, perhaps some people convey misinformation unintentionally, is not that they are trying to or that they have some bad motivations behind it. I mean, does it have something to do with this?
I would actually set that. So I would set the intent question aside. So, so just like to quickly clarify, usually when people refer to disinformation, that implies that there is an intent to deceive. Misinformation doesn't imply anything about intent. And I would say like intent is even more difficult than the stuff that I've just talked about. It's like you can't read people's minds, right? And so I'd rather set that question aside. I mean, it's difficult enough to get a handle on this ground truth problem. And so yeah, just to your question, I think we do have well-established procedures for for uncovering truth and facts, right? So like the best one we know is the scientific process. And if there's anything we know about the scientific process, it's incredibly costly and time-consuming, subject to error, hopefully self-correcting over time, but it's just a very, very resource-intensive, collaborative effort. And that's just not something that you can do at scale, and certainly not at the speed that you would need, as like a journalist or a fact checker or say a social media platform. And science doesn't always get at the right answer on the first try. And so, the scientific process is great, but I think there isn't like a well-known shortcut to the truth. And so that just means it's very difficult to come to an agreement. I know that from my own attempts to kind of try to code individual articles as to whether they're true or false. Sometimes, and I would say often most of the time, it's sort of difficult to come to an answer one way or another. And doing this kind of research has made me really appreciate the job of fact checkers because I think it's a really, really hard job. And the ground is constantly shifting under your feet.
Do we know anything about the percentage of news in different media that are fake news?
So now we're talking about this term fake news, which has been used more recently to describe a form of misinformation that comes, it basically it has the trappings of legitimate news. There are a number of websites that were set up to kind of mimic legitimate news sources, but basically existed to publish kind of false and misleading content and to perhaps, confuse voters or have various types of political goals. So on the one hand, you can ask, questions about misinformation, whether a particular claim or a particular article is true or false. But when we're talking about fake news here, often the question is framed in terms of sources. So rather than look at individual claims and articles, we're looking at a particular source. Typically, what scholars do who study, fake news or online misinformation, what they do is they try to make determinations at the source level, because that actually makes the task of agreeing on the ground truth a little bit more tractable. And so often what you'll see are categorizations of things like untrustworthy websites or credible or non-credible websites. So I think that's like the level at which this conversation becomes easier to have. So one example here is there have been some organizations like NewsGuard, which is this third-party organization, which is comprised of many journalists and professionals who basically try to categorize thousands of websites around the world along a certain set of criteria that basically tell us whether or not a source of information is trustworthy, whether they have procedures in place that make the information that they publish believable or not, whether they have processes in place for correcting information when it's not true, that sort of thing. And so there they have, you end up with a determination of how trustworthy any individual source is. And it becomes not about the believability of any single story that they publish, but about the process that they have in place and the norms and the professional standards that they adhere to for producing content in general. And that tells us more about like the standards that they apply to themselves. So anyway, you know, one way to sort of answer your question is to say, okay, among all the websites that, you know, organizations like these have evaluated, you know, what percentage are, you know, like obviously just sort of, you know, promoting, you know, falsehoods or misleading information, and what percentage are trying to get it right or adhere to some basic minimal standards of factual accuracy. And there, I think you'll find that a majority are like perfectly like legitimate, or at least like trying to be legitimate news organizations, at least as far as I can tell. I think the sort of second question is, okay, that's like the universe of websites, but what about like the set of websites that people actually visit? You know, what percentage of those are actually fake news? And there, I would say, again, you know, it's pretty concentrated minority, in the sense that most people, depending on how you count, like 80-90% of people will very rarely encounter an article from like one of these really obviously untrustworthy websites.
Right. But I mean, when you talk about these different websites, are you referring both to mainstream sources of news and alternative media, or is it that one of them is more problematic in terms of conveying fake news than the other?
So, you know, in these kinds of, you know, when trying to kind of evaluate the basic standards and practices of websites, you're looking at everything, right? Including mainstream news organizations, like more recent, like alternative news organizations, like explicitly partisan news, that sort of thing. It's, you know, the thing about these kinds of evaluations is that, you know, basically most established media are going to like pass this test, in the sense that, you know, they're incumbents, they're established, they are members of professional organizations, they hire, you know, journalists who commit to certain ideals, or say they commit to certain ideals, right? Like they sort of play, they're established news players, and they have newsrooms, and they like have all of these like institutional features that would allow them to kind of pass any kind of evaluation. Any kind of evaluation of quality beyond that is going to enter into kind of subjective territory, and it's going to get really, really hard for people to just agree on it. And that's just sort of the reality of doing these kinds of evaluations.
But on the internet, is it only a minority of people that are exposed to false information, to fake news, or not?
As best as we can tell, but again, this is using like the pretty strict definitions that I've been talking about, right? So as best as we can tell, you know, using relatively strict definitions of websites that are not trustworthy, then yes, it seems that a minority of people are kind of frequently exposed to misinformation online. I mean, it's important to kind of know what we can't observe, right? So like when making these kinds of determinations, we can observe what people are seeing, for example, in their Facebook news feeds, but not clicking on. So like, you might be scrolling through a lot of stuff that's total propaganda, but not clicking on it. And so researchers would never be able to observe it. You know, another like really important dimension here is streaming video, obviously, you know, YouTube. There's now like a bunch of really interesting descriptive work that people are doing, trying to understand what the information ecosystem on YouTube looks like. And like there, I think kind of the conclusions that I've been talking to you about also sort of apply. Although there, I think like we still know a little bit less because it's much more fluid. And then there's like the world of like podcasts, for example, about which we know very little, but like, that's sort of what's interesting about online media and just like, you know, digital media in general, is that it is constantly shifting. And so every time there's a new development, like there's new people raise new concerns, like, oh, what if people are getting misinformation this way? And so far, like I haven't seen a reason to like raise the alarm in terms of people being totally surrounded by misinformation in their day-to-day lives. But, you know, things can always change.
Yeah. But are there lots of people that share fake news?
No. So, I mean, I think we have a pretty good answer to this one. So, you know, after 2016, so the Brexit in the UK, Trump is elected in the US, a lot of people, including the social platforms, became very concerned about the tendency of people to share misinformation or disinformation in ways that could just like totally cloud and distort the larger information environment. And, you know, once people did some more careful studies of this, it turns out that a vanishingly small minority of people ever share this kind of content. So, for example, there was one study on Twitter which found that these people they classified as super sharers, so about 0.1% of voters on Twitter, were responsible for 80% of the sharing of misinformation on Twitter. And so that sort of tells you the pattern, right? So it's like a very small proportion of people who are responsible for most of the retweeted misinformation content. So on the one hand, I think it's sort of reassuring in the sense that it's not like a widespread behavior. But on the other hand, it means that there are these like distorting consequences in the sense that you can be exposed to misinformation shared by other people or retweeted by other people. And so there are these sort of network effects to contend with. But these network effects are also things that are subject to, you know, platform design, algorithmic tweaks and that sort of thing. And that takes us beyond just individual behavior.
Do we know if this issue of online misinformation is a partisan issue in any way? I mean, is it that people that are part of one party or that are on one side of the political aisle are more susceptible to misinformation than the other?
Well, so I have two answers to that. So first, okay. I mean, the sort of empirical pattern at the present moment is clear. And that is, so again, I'm just going to focus on the US, and I apologize again for my like very specific
sure.
focus. You know, first is that if you just look at the partisan lean of most online websites that are classified as publishing untrustworthy information, it's hugely skewed towards kind of conservative and Republican sources.
Okay.
So if you look at the partisan balance of misinformation, as best as we can tell, it's way more likely to be conservative than liberal. And that also dovetails with some of the kind of concerns that people had about the role of misinformation in the presidential election, which is that, you know, you have sort of populists who kind of attack the system. And they see the kind of establishment as biased against them. And so they turn to alternative sources to reach their voters. And, you know, these are not subject to the same kinds of, you know, factual scrutiny as mainstream news. And so you get this sort of misinformation ecosystem that surrounds these candidates that are looking to, you know, kind of ride this populist wave. And so that's the concern. Like the empirical reality is clear. Not surprisingly, given that the supply of misinformation is so skewed, you also see differences at the individual level. So, for example, you know, conservatives and Republicans are much more likely to share misinformation and to consume misinformation than liberals. But that could also just be a reflection of the fact that the supply side is so skewed. And so that's why I say, like, we can tell you what the empirical reality looks like now. But these kinds of individual level patterns could be simply a reflection of this sort of larger skew in the overall misinformation ecosystem. So that's sort of what we know. And I think, you know, beyond that, I can say that there's a lot of kind of research and a lot of inquiries into whether, you know, there are more like substantial biases in information processes that biases in information processing that can lead to these kinds of asymmetries. And like there are a bunch of hypotheses that people are exploring. But basically that's what we know. I think in principle, there's no reason why this kind of skew would have to persist indefinitely, right? You could imagine like the political reality changing and misinformation becoming more prevalent on the left. But that's basically what we're seeing now.
But do you have any hypotheses about what those kinds of biases could be, and perhaps why, for example, conservatives would be more susceptible to these kinds of biases than liberals?
Yeah. So one, and this is probably more specific to the US, is just there's just been a sort of longstanding strain of skepticism towards scientific consensus and institutional media and just institutions in general among the conservative movement. And so, you know, this sort of style of kind of attacking and critiquing the mainstream and just established media kind of much more easily translates into kind of acceptance of like claims from alternative sources than it would, for example, people on the left, who, if you look at surveys, tend to just have much higher levels of trust in existing institutions. And so, you know, those predispositions have been there for decades in the US. And so that's kind of one reason why you might expect that, you know, people might be more susceptible on the right than the left to misinformation. But, you know, I think a much more simple and mundane possibility is just that we're looking at like age cohort differences. And so this is one set of explanations that you've seen people explore, which is that, okay, like there is a correlation between age and ideology. Older people are less likely to be digital natives. A lot of this misinformation is propagated through social platforms, and people just may not have the digital literacy necessary to evaluate the quality of information that they see. And especially once you factor in, like, okay, you have political campaigns that are trying to target potential supporters. And so, you know, older people might actually encounter much more misinformation than others. Then that creates a sort of dynamic where it can actually be really, really hard for people to even discern between high quality and low quality information. And then that could also lead to the kinds of patterns that we're seeing here. And all of that is just correlated with partisanship and ideology as well. But it could just be confounded with age.
Right. And so that would mean then that because older people tend to be more conservative politically they don't have much media literacy, then by being exposed to this sort of content, they wouldn't have the cognitive tools to process it correctly, and so would be more susceptible to being misinformed.
That's the idea. Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay. So let me just ask you another thing. So do we know if political ads and political campaigns on social media work?
Yeah, so that's another one of these things that's really hard to answer. So there've been a few studies that try to rigorously evaluate the impact of online ads. And again, I would say here the evidence is quite mixed. I would not say that there's strong evidence that ads on social media have kind of strong measurable effects on political opinions or behavior such as voting. There's a whole set of research where people try to identify the effect of advertising from television, for example, on voting. And that too is sort of, it's really, really difficult to you know, cut through this tangle of conflicting findings. But I think, you know, the most recent, probably best evidence suggests that there is a real but relatively modest short-term effect of television advertising on like turnout. You know, I guess there's no reason to think that something similar might be true online, except that on social media, you know, people are often exposed to such a wide array of different things at the same time. Like you imagine like the number of things that you scroll by or the number of different kinds of sources of information that you see when you look at your feeds and you open your social media accounts. And so I just think there's a lot more things competing for your attention. And so, you know, there are also just reasons to think why effects might be even weaker when you look at ads from social media. I mean, that said, I just don't think we have very good evidence one way or another. Certainly, the state of the evidence is far removed from like the tenor of the public discussion around ads on social platforms, which almost sort of assume that they have like massive propagandistic effects on people. I mean, there's just really no good evidence that that's true.
Mm-hmm. Are political surveys on social media reliable? I mean, of course, we could also talk about the traditional kinds of surveys and if they are also reliable or not, but talking specifically about the ones that are done on social media.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what kind of surveys you have in mind, but I can think of a few examples where I think social platforms like Facebook are actually at a huge advantage for being able to collect high quality survey data. So one prominent example is over the past year, Facebook has collaborated with a huge international consortium of researchers to conduct a COVID symptoms tracker. And you know, you may have seen this yourself if you go on Facebook. Like, there's often a survey at the top which asks you to answer a few questions. And this has been like this massive international effort. I'm sure they've interviewed many millions of people. And so that's just like at a scale that it's just not possible through traditional survey techniques. If you also think about the information that Facebook has about all of their users, they can model non-response in a way that's completely impossible through traditional survey techniques as well. And so, you know, I don't know for sure. I haven't seen any of the final reports from this project, but in principle, you could imagine just much, much higher quality and more precise polling that would be possible through these kinds of techniques than through traditional methods. And I mean, this is clearly a special case, right? Like, the world is interested in tracking like COVID behaviors COVID symptoms, in many different regions and like over time and among different subgroups. And so having a big collaborative effort to do it sort of makes sense. I don't think we're seeing anytime soon these kinds of efforts being replicated for like political campaigns or like on behalf of news organizations or that sort of thing. And so that's where things, I think, get a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So just to talk a little bit about the kinds of solutions we have at hand to fight back against misinformation, does fact-checking work?
Yes, as far as we can tell. That's a pithy answer, but basically there's been a bunch of attempts to study the effects of fact-checking over the past decade or so. After an initial bit of worries around whether fact-checking can backfire. So basically the worry was, okay, I believe in some, I hold some misperception. I'm going to get a fact-check telling me that I'm wrong, and I'm going to resist the fact-check so much that I'm going to double down on my misperception, and I'll be even more misinformed than I was before I got the fact-check. So there were some initial worries that that might be one of the dangers of this practice, but that finding basically hasn't replicated. And so a large body of work has now developed around fact-checking that generally finds positive effects. So fact-checks make people better informed on average. They seem to work like regardless of like what kind of person you are, like regardless of your political background, regardless of your age, like regardless of any other kinds of characteristics. And so it seems to work as a sort of general all-purpose tool for counteracting misperceptions. And there seem to be very few kind of downsides to it. That said, it's not, a cure-all, like any of these kinds of interventions. It can improve the accuracy of your factual beliefs, but it doesn't necessarily change your behavior. It's not going to make you more likely to get a vaccine, as far as we can tell. Like, fact checks aren't going to like change your attitudes about political leaders on the basis of the new information that you learned. And so their effects may be limited, but they do seem to do the thing that they're designed to do, which is improve the quality of the information that you have.
Mm-hmm. And they work also with people that have already been previously exposed to the sort of misinformation fact checking is trying to
Yes.
deal with.
Yes, as far as we can tell.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when we talk about social media literacy and how we can apply it to fake news and misinformation, are there specific strategies that we know people can use and learn to use to deal with misinformation and fake news and to know how to distinguish between reliable and unreliable sources of news?
Yeah, so the one of the challenges with fact checking. So despite the things that I just said about, the fact that they seem to work pretty well, they're still costly. Fact checks are costly to produce, right? You have to employ fact checkers. It's intensive work, and it's time consuming. And so while they may be effective, it can be difficult to scale fact checking up. And that's the problem that platforms like Facebook have had when they've partnered with fact checkers, right? That they've reached a hard limit in terms of the number of stories on any given day that they can actually fact check. And so that just means that it's effectively impossible to like scrutinize the total number of claims that have been made on any given day, right? I mean, that would be impossible. And so there's been a search for kind of more scalable, less costly, types of interventions that might give people themselves the tools to, improve their information diets or improve the strategies that they use to seek out, ways to inform themselves. And that's the idea behind digital literacy interventions. So we touched on this before that, one of the reasons why misinformation might be prevalent among some groups is just that they have lower levels of digital literacy. And so one of the promises also of this kind of strategy is that it could actually improve people's skills, right? There's nothing like permanent necessarily about lacking like skills or experience with navigating online media and like navigating social platforms. So it's something that can be improved. So digital media literacy interventions are basically designed to just show people in a very simple way a set of shortcuts and strategies for evaluating individual pieces of information or news posts or claims that they might encounter in their day-to-day kind of social media activity. So one thing that I've tested, for example, with my collaborators is a set of tips that were disseminated by Facebook itself to try and improve the digital literacy skills of its own users. And so these are very simple, straightforward things that you or I would probably think is sort of second nature, but might not be obvious to everyone, right? So like check the headline. Like, is the headline making a really fantastical claim? Check other sources, like are other sources of information saying the same thing? Like this sort of thing. And giving people these kinds of very basic low-cost strategies that they can employ themselves. And as best as we can find, it works really well in helping people to distinguish between news posts that come from really untrustworthy sources and those that come from like established trustworthy sources of information. And the effects may be lasting as well. So that's sort of like a promising result.
So, just one last question. Do you think that people who use social media and are frequently exposed to digital media in general should be worried about misinformation? And if so, what could they do about it in their daily lives?
So yeah, that's an interesting question. I think first of all, the kinds of strategies that I've talked about, so digital literacy, fact checking, that sort of thing. I don't think these are solutions that can sort of end misinformation, right? They're not going to like solve the problem on their own. If anything, they can maybe help mitigate it and sort of make it easier for people to kind of navigate their online world. The larger problem of misinformation, the fact that there are outlets that see it as profitable to produce misinformation, like those are kind of more systemic issues that I think have more to do with sort of platforms and how they're designed and like their kinds of policies. But I still think that there's a lot that people can do. And one thing that people can do is, you know, when they encounter something that's like misleading or inflammatory that was shared by a friend or a family member or someone else that they're connected to on social media, is to, you know, reach out and try to gently push back against it. And that's sort of one tool that people do have at their disposal, which is the fact that you have a personal connection to someone means that they might listen to you if you show them, like, hey, you know, I don't think this is true. Like, here's another source of information you might want to take a look and think twice before you share this kind of information from this source again. I think it's, you know, people hesitate to do it because it can be sort of uncomfortable. But one of the other things that we've learned from social science research in this area is that people can actually be really receptive when, you know, when someone presents information to them in a way that's not combative, right? And it's done in a respectful way, and it's done using this sort of shared like connection that you have, rather than in a way that's meant to be sort of like insulting or otherwise otherwise might kind of engender a reaction. So I think that's like an everyday thing that people can do, and that seems to be effective.
But do you think that in general people should be worried about being exposed to misinformation online?
So my honest answer to this, like based on this conversation that we've had, so I think the risk from kind of direct exposure to like clearly false or misleading claims is relatively low. I think it's lower than you might think just based on this larger discussion around misinformation. The larger risk that I've sort of implied is like harder to quantify is from kind of misinformation that comes from, you know, mainstream institutions. And, news journalists can report information that ends up being false, but maybe isn't true, maybe isn't obvious at the time. Or political leaders can say things that are like kind of true, but also kind of misleading. And that takes you into this gray area where it's not just something false to be fact-checked. And it's not just being published by, these sorts of niche, partisan websites, but is actually being propagated by like large, news organizations around the world. These are the kinds of claims and this sort of larger environment of confusion that I think is more worrisome at the end of the day than the kind of like relatively, relatively distinctive pieces of misinformation that we can identify and specifically counteract. And that's something that I think also just requires kind of building skills and like personal resilience and skepticism. But I think is like, there isn't a simple solution like fact-checking that can solve this problem. That's just the challenge of being a citizen in the 21st century world.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Guest, just before we go, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I have a website. So it's just my name, Andy Guest, GUESS.com. You can find me on Google Scholar, and I'm on my Princeton website as well. So all of my work is on there. I'm also on Twitter at Andy Guest, GUESS. And I hope to see you on there, and I hope to hear more from you.
Okay, great. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming
on
the show.
Yeah, thanks so much. Take care.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been posting interviews for the past 3 years and a half, and I need your support to keep the channel running, and so please pay a visit to my Patreon page and consider making a pledge there for as little as $1 a month. And you also have links to PayPal if you prefer it in the description box of the interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perorga Larsen, Laguerreiro, Francis Ford, Hans Frederik Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whiting, Bernardo Wolf, Tim Hollesy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Pauline Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Guintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windega, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Colombo, Jorge Pinha, Phil Cavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blyth, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Aubrey Hickson, Fergal Cousin, Evan Podrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Liebrandt, Özlem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, JW, João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adan Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Miren B, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostaszewski, Max Bailby, Nelek Back, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Elman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmides, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yegi, my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafinha, Kian Gilligan, Sérgio Codriano, Luís Caetano, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardas France, and Niruban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.